Welcome to the Making Footprints, Not Blueprints podcast. My name is Andrew James Brown and I'm the minister of the Unitarian Church in Cambridge, UK. Knowing that full scope always eludes our grasp, that there is no finality of vision, that we have perceived nothing completely and that, therefore, tomorrow a new walk is a new walk, I hope that, on occasions, you'll find here a helpful liberal, religious and philosophical reflection that encourages you to journey through life, making footprints rather than blueprints. Welcome. The Quantum Manger, a Christmas Eve meditation. A short thought for the day offered to the Cambridge Unitarian Church as part of the Sunday service of mindful meditation. Back in March 2023, I listened to a Financial Times podcast on the subject of quantum computing, because I was interested in understanding, as much as a non-mathematician and physicist can, what the basic difference is between a classical computer and a quantum computer. To help people like me, Madhumita Murgia, who leads the FT's coverage about artificial intelligence and writes on data and emerging technologies, interviewed the theoretical physicist and philosopher Sean Carroll, who specialises in quantum mechanics, cosmology and philosophy of science, and is currently the Homewood Professor of Natural Philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. Obviously, I can't precis the whole programme for you here, and so should you be interested in listening to it, you can find a link to it on my blog. But one thing in the podcast struck me as saying something about how the world is that I found very helpful also to think about in relationship to human myths, and in particular to the myth of Christmas. And it's something to do with bits, B-I-T-S, bits. So Carroll reminds us that, quote, in classical computers you start with a set of bits. A bit is just some register in your computer that is either 0 or 1. And you can use a string of bits to make a binary number and represent anything that you'd like. Unquote. Now, all the computers we use in our daily lives encode their information in bits. But in the quantum world, where physicists have revealed that things can be in more than one state at the same time, it began to become possible to consider the idea that perhaps bits didn't need only to be noughts and ones. And so came into being the idea of the quantum bit, or qubit. Murgia then continues, quote, one way to imagine this is that the bits in a classical computer are coins that are either heads or tails. But a qubit in a quantum computer is a spinning coin. It's kind of heads and tails at the same time. That means the computer isn't limited to representing just one string of ones and noughts. It can represent lots of combinations of ones and noughts simultaneously. That gives it the potential for much more computing power. Unquote. And when she speaks about potentially a lot more computing power, that means a lot more computing power. And the task of those currently exploring quantum computing is to turn this insight into how the world works at a subatomic level into an actual working quantum computer. In the rest of the podcast, Murgia and Carroll give a few indications about how that project is unfolding. But at this point, I leave their fascinating conversation to begin to return to the world of human myth, and today, specifically, to the nativity stories of Matthew and Luke, which together form the myth of Christmas. Now, I am grateful, almost beyond measure, to have received my theological education in the liberal Protestant tradition that was committed to what is known as historical criticism. The historical critical method it used is one concerned to understand the origin of the biblical, and indeed all other texts, by attempting to understand the historical context that lay behind the text. Historical criticism begins in the 17th century, and over the next three centuries it becomes the central way the liberal Protestant tradition engaged with the biblical texts, developing along the way three additional related methods. Firstly, there came into being source criticism, which attempts to seek out the original sources, written and or oral, which lie behind a given biblical text. Secondly, there came into being form criticism, which divides the texts into discrete sections and then further categorizes them by genres, such as prose, poetry, letters, laws, etc. Form criticism also asks about the text's original Sitz im Leben, or setting in life, in which it was composed and first used. And thirdly, there came into being redaction criticism, in which is studied the collection, arrangement, editing, and rewriting of sources. So, in short, at university, I was taught always to be asking where, when, and by whom the texts were written, and then, by extension, to go on to ask how they were then understood and received throughout the centuries. This latter study is called reception theory, or reader-response criticism. It's a fascinating study, and I cannot overemphasize how important this work has been, because it has ensured that our liberal, creative, free spiritual tradition is no longer bound to literal interpretations of the Bible, or indeed any other religious text. It has helped us become acutely aware that all religious texts are human constructs through and through, which have originated in historical contexts often very, very different from our own. Now, in turn, at its best, this historical critical perspective frees us to make appropriate attempts to draw from these texts fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight, and then to gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, begin to walk a path that is safer than the known way. In this method is our freedom to be tomorrow what we are not today. It's important to see that the historical critical process also helps us keep in view and know about things in which we now no longer believe or can accept as appropriate ways of being in the world. This too is a precious gift, keeping us from falling back into bad ways of being and clearly false beliefs. Not surprisingly, the application of the historical critical method necessarily raised again and again the question of whether the events the authors of the text wrote about were historically true or not. In other words, whether they were fact or fiction. Of course, this is a vitally important thing to know. But in the hands of the overzealous and insensitive, the method has, alas, occasionally delivered up a version of the classical computer bit, in the form of a belief that a story is either historical fact or an imaginary fiction, a kind of one or zero. And a situation can develop where true stories, that is to say, historical fact, are allowed to be kept, and all fictional stories, that is to say, stories which are not historically true, are to be abandoned as false. But, as most of us intuitively know, many of the greatest truths have come to us through fictional stories, poetry, and myth. But the problem at Christmas is that today we know, and make no mistake about it, we really do know this. We know that the events recounted in the myth of Christmas did not occur. These are fictional accounts with very little basis in history. So when viewed solely through the eyes of the historical critical scholar, the manger in Bethlehem is always and only empty, to the point almost of vanishing. And I have always felt that the great poet, R.S. Thomas, must surely have had just such a scholar in mind when he wrote Lost Christmas. He is alone. It is Christmas. Up the hill go three trees, the three kings. There is a star also over the dark manger. But where is the child? Pity him, he has come far like the trees, matching their patience with his. But the mind was before him on the long road. The manger is empty. However, when viewed through the mythopoetic eyes of the creative storyteller or poet, the manger in Bethlehem is always capable of being found full to the point of overflowing. And my favourite poem expressing this was written by Juan Ramon Jimenez and is called The Lamb Barred Gently. The lamb barred gently. The tender donkey showed its joy in lusty bray. The dog barked playfully, almost talking to the stars. I could not sleep. I went outdoors and saw heavenly tracks upon the ground, all flower-decked like a sky, turned upside down. A warm and fragrant mist hovered over the grove. The moon was sinking low in a soft golden west of divine orbit. My breast beat without a pause, as if my heart had whined. I opened wide the stable door to see if he were there. He was. As each new Christmas comes around, it strikes me more and more forcibly that we in this liberal, creative, free spiritual community need to learn to develop what I'm tempted to call a quantum manger. A manger which will never finally and definitively show up to us either as heads empty or tails full, but one which always already continues to spin creatively and which allows us with a clean heart to stand before a manger that is always already empty, always already full, and in all possible states in between. Think of the creative possibilities this might help to release into our world that is being so damaged by the imposition of simplistic binaries upon reality. A reality that, to paraphrase Werner Heisenberg, who was one of the main pioneers of the theory of quantum mechanics, is not only more complex and creative than we think, but more complex and creative than we can think. And that brings us to the end of this edition of the Making Footprints, Not Blueprints podcast. So, farewell for now, and remember, tomorrow a new walk is a new walk. See you on the path.